Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Winston Churchill is honored at the U.S. Capitol. Some think it's as much of a political gotcha as a symbol of national gratitude. We'll be talking about it in a couple of moments. But first, what does the term compassion fatigue mean to you? Some might call it the burnout that can affect anyone exposed to highly emotional or stressful situations. It can have serious consequences for home caregivers, healthcare professionals, and even first responders. It's significant enough that Barnes Jewish Hospital has been running a compassion fatigue program to deal with it for some 3 years now. On today's program, we'll talk about what compassion fatigue is, its consequences, and what can be done about it. Joining me in studio, all from Barnes Jewish Hospital, Pat Potter, Director of Research and the Compassion Fatigue Program Developer. Kathy Powers is a clinical nurse specialist and former bedside nurse who now teaches compassion fatigue. Sharon Rodriguez is Director of Patient Experience. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
Pat, I'll start with you because I think what we really need is a very specific definition of what compassion fatigue is.
Sure. Compassion fatigue is basically a combination of two elements. One is what we call secondary traumatic stress, and that's the emotional pain and suffering one feels from taking care of others who suffer. So, for example, an oncology nurse who sees a person come day after day, week after week back for chemotherapy and sees their condition progressively worsen, that takes a toll on them. The second part is burnout. And burnout is when an individual perceives that the demands of their work outweigh the resources that are available. So no matter how hard you work, if you feel like you don't have enough staffing or enough equipment or support services, that takes a toll, and then the two together create compassion fatigue.
Is there any way to compare this with post-traumatic stress syndrome? I mean, it sounds, your definition sounds a little like it.
Absolutely. Post-traumatic stress is when you directly are experiencing the trauma. Secondary traumatic stress is witnessing that.
But it would be a mistake to simply refer to this as burnout.
Correct.
Yeah, correct. Okay.
It's been alluded to that way in the literature, but the more current work that's going on really tries to define the two different components.
Kathy, it's my understanding that this is something that you underwent during your time as a bedside nurse. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct, Don. I would probably make a case that most caregivers probably experience that. You may not know when it's occurring that that's indeed what you're experiencing, but it's just this feeling that I don't have any more to give, or I come back day after day and I don't see conditions improve, or I have to work harder and harder, and even work kind of interfering with your sleep or finding yourself becoming increasingly irritable would be signs of compassion fatigue.
How did you deal with it?
You know, at that time, you just kind of thought it was part of the job, and you kind of just sucked it up and hoped for better the next day or feel better after a vacation. But what I would notice in coworkers is many would leave the area or leave the profession of nursing altogether because they just couldn't do it anymore. And it became kind of frightening that you couldn't practice for a lifetime because eventually the work was going to be too much for you.
And it's not like it's an overcrowded profession. If
right.
people are leaving it, that's,
right.
not, that's not good. Sean, what about the impact on patients?
Well, one of the things we do when we work on the patient experience is actually we want to make sure that we're taking care of our team members. Team members who are stressed, who are burnt out, who are compassion fatigued, will not be able to provide the most adequate care possible. And so this is about compassion for our team members and making sure that we are helping them help themselves.
Pat, back to you with regard to the program that you've established and developed at Barnes. How basically does that work, and who would be involved in it?
Well, the program itself involves an 8-hour class. We offer it twice a month, and we actually have opened it up to any staff member in the hospital. To date, most of the people who attend the class are nurses, but we have people such as clerical people, educators, physical therapists, what have you. The course is 8 hours, and we go through explaining what is compassion fatigue, the effects that that stress has on us when we're involved in caregiving, and then we spend a good portion of the time really talking about what we call the resiliency skills, of the skills that you can use and then apply in your job day to day to help manage compassion fatigue.
And what might some of those be?
Well, basically there are five. First of all is what we call self-regulation. Secondly, intentionality. Then we have professional maturation, connection, and self-care. Self-regulation is we teach people very simple exercise on relaxation that they use at the time when they perceive a stress. So it's not like going away and taking 30 minutes and having a lot of time to do relaxation. It's learning how to really control your nervous system so that you can turn off high stress and get into a more relaxed state. The intentionality is teaching people to reflect back on why did I become a caregiver in the first place? What is my professional covenant? How can I be honest and have good integrity and care for people and not get absorbed in all the negativity around me? And then the emphasis is on professional maturation, feeling good about what you can contribute and realizing that all you can do day to day in this kind of job is the best you can. And connection, the importance of sharing your stories when you have difficult times with other caregivers so you have people who will listen and give you someone who you can share a story with. And then finally, self-care is critical. People have to be able to, when they finish a busy, stressful day, being able to turn it off and then take care of themselves so they can refuel for the next day.
Kathy, you teach it, and I think I know how you're going to answer this question, but is 8 hours enough to go through all of this?
I think yes would be my answer. The day ends up kind of being a gift to staff because it's not your typical class where you sit and you take notes. I mean, your eyes are kind of open to things you already knew, but then different ways of handling them. So I think there's a lot of relief to that. 8 hours is enough, I think, to learn the concepts, but it takes a lifetime to practice them. So I think that, you know, that's where the follow-up needs to be, making sure people are able to practice those skills. And then, like Sean said, to know that we support them.
Yeah, that's obviously very important to know that there is a support mechanism there. But I'd like to go back to the patients. Do the patients ever come to you or people who you work with and say, I think there's a problem here?
So actually, one of the things my team does is a process that we call leader rounding on patients, and it's something we coach our leaders to do and that we do as a practice. And so we'll check on patients and ask them some very specific questions around their experience and what they're going through. And many times it will lead to identifying a team member who may be suffering from compassion fatigue.
But not everybody necessarily is going to suffer from this problem. I understand there's a particular type of personality, perhaps more likely to do so.
Well, it's interesting. I think Kathy and I would say that there's probably few caregivers that don't experience some symptoms of compassion fatigue. But I would agree that not everyone has a really serious, you know, condition for as far as that goes. I'm sorry, and you asked me?
Not everybody is susceptible to it. I ask that because in my notes here I have that fact that it generally affects those with an enhanced drive for perfection.
And also the research shows that people who tend to be more empathic are much more vulnerable to compassion fatigue as well. Mm-hmm. Nurse specialists is a group that's interesting. They have very high goals and high expectations of what they want to do. And when they feel that within their roles they're no longer able to do that, they tend to be fairly vulnerable. But interestingly, among our staff, we've actually found that the highest percentage of burnout and secondary traumatic stress is affecting our staff who've been with us for less than a year.
So they're the newbies.
The newbies really are hit with a lot that very first year. They're not really prepared for what the experience is like.
Kathy, that the way it worked for you?
Yes, and I see it in the faces of some of the young nurses that come to the class. I don't think they thought they were going to get there that fast where I don't know if I can do this anymore. And it's our hopes to kind of give them tools so that they can practice for a lifetime, as well as kind of rejuvenate them and really, you know, take them back to why they got into this work in the first place and that joy.
I have an acquaintance whose daughter is a nurse in a neonatal intensive care unit. And I've said to her on a number of occasions, I can't understand how she could do this for any length of time without simply losing it. And she said she loves it. She looks forward to going to work every day, even though we all know what that is dealing with. That surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me. She sounds very engaged in the work that she does. But I think you could probably also ask her questions about how her work is impacted or if it interferes with sleep. Does she dream that she's at work or, you know, come home irritable, those kinds of things. And then you might find that there is indeed, you know, compassion fatigue there, or that's what we all share in common.
So this, I think it's been made clear, this can be happening to someone and they don't even know what it is that is going on. You know, I'd like to take this away from the hospital for a moment because there's another group of caregivers, and we all know about home caregivers and what they go through. And it's the same kind of thing, I'm sure, except they don't generally have the support team around them to Sean and his team there to help.
Absolutely, an excellent point. And there's a lot of people who really are in the family caregiving role who probably shouldn't be in it. My doctoral work was involved family caregiving. And one thing that I learned from that is that if there's not a good relational connection between the caregiver and the person they're caring for, it makes family caregiving even more difficult. Family caregivers truly see their own health decline over the course of time. There's really some good research showing how they don't see their own health care provider, they don't follow their own diet and exercise regimens, they may stop taking their medications regularly, and their health declines. You can see it within about 5 years if they've really been in a long-term caregiving situation.
So what's your advice to them?
Well, I think a lot more does need to be done on a public level about compassion fatigue and its influence. And compassion fatigue has not yet got into the family caregiving literature yet. So there's still a lot that we need to be doing in terms of education and also research on the topic. I think that family caregivers need to find somebody they can connect with to share their stories, who is a good listener. And there are different programs out there available on relaxation, the importance of self-care. Family caregivers can get some respite. They need to be able to be willing to work through home health agencies and whatever, and getting respite care sometimes when they can actually step away. I think they need to find if there's other resources in the family who can share the burden of caregiving. In our research, we found a lot of patients actually do have multiple family caregivers, but I cannot tell you whether or not they tend to cope better than single caregivers. I don't know that.
Kathy, the respite idea sounds like a good one, and I've heard it said from acquaintances of mine again that they just have to get away for a couple of days, and that's perfectly understandable. But what about the nurses in the hospital? They're expected to come to work the next day.
To come back the next day. Some of our work with compassion fatigue, Don, is based on a quote by Viktor Frankl that says, "That which is to give life must endure burning." And what we're trying to teach our caregivers to do is to refuel themselves by taking care of themselves, by practicing self-regulation, rather than burning themselves up so that they don't feel like they cannot possibly come back tomorrow.
Our subject today is compassion fatigue. We'll continue that conversation in just a moment. I'd be particularly interested in hearing from members of our audience who have had some sort of experience with compassion fatigue, how you dealt with it and how it presented itself to you. My guests in studio today are Pat Potter, Director of Research and Compassion Fatigue Program Developer at Barnes Jewish Hospital. Kathy Powers is a clinical nurse specialist, former bedside nurse who suffered, if I may use that term, from compassion fatigue. She now teaches it at Barnes. Also with us is Sean Rodriguez, Director of Patient Experience at Barnes Hospital. We'll be back with more of the conversation. And again, we'd like to hear from you at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air, and we hope to hear from you. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue our conversation on compassion fatigue, a kind of burnout that healthcare providers often suffer from. And we're talking about how to deal with that today, as well as what it is. Pat Potter, Kathy Powers, and Sean Rodriguez, all from Barnes Jewish Hospital, all have extensive experience in dealing with this and are with us in studio. You were saying something quite interesting, Pat, off the air with regard to how the neonatal intensive care unit that I mentioned might be a little bit different than the oncology unit, for instance.
Well, there is a lot of work looking at differences in terms of the occurrence and severity of compassion fatigue across different types of nursing units. And in something like a neonatal ICU, the ratio of nurses to patients is a bit smaller than, let's say, a general medicine floor in the hospital. That in itself means that the nurse probably has a few more resources at his or her control. The other thing is, and this can go both ways, those nurses can form really good relationships with those patients and families over time. That can be a detriment, particularly if the outcome for the patient is a negative one. But that relational piece, I think, really helps in providing a lot of reward for what the nurse does.
Is this something, Kathy, I'll put this to you, is this something that might be present itself more typically when dealing with terminally ill patients as opposed to those with long-term problems that aren't necessarily terminal?
Absolutely, Don. And I think Pat has the research to show that our oncology caregiving population is at a higher risk for this, as well as our trauma population. And I would probably make a case for anyone who works in intensive care units because you do see people that are really devastatingly ill.
How about emergency rooms? Same thing.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah.
Sean, I'd like to turn this around a little bit and find out if in the work that you do, you have determined perhaps that patients at times, knowing what's going on, have a sense of guilt about being responsible for someone else's discomfort.
Absolutely. Actually, I was rounding on a patient and their family just a couple of weeks ago, and they were in a situation where they had dealt with someone who was compassion fatigued, and they were guilty. They felt guilty, I should say. It's something that we don't want our patients to feel. It's something that we want to make sure that we are providing them with the most excellent care possible, which is why we have this program. We want to make sure those situations and scenarios are minimized and eradicated in our setting.
Counseling, psychological counseling perhaps, does it go that far?
Well, we start with the compassion fatigue program. The challenge is we can't force anyone to go through the program.
Are you talking about patients going through the program as well?
Oh, I'm actually talking about the team members that we identify by talking to the patients. With the patients, to me, that's a service recovery event. Mm-hmm. You know, when we identify a situation because they see the staff as stressed or burnt out or is acting in a fashion they shouldn't because of the compassion fatigue that they're under. To me, that's a service recovery event where we make sure that the patient really feels that they're at the center of the care that we're providing. They should not be put in the place where they're the ones feeling like they should be caring for the caregiver. Which is why we're very this is a program that we strongly support and that we want our team members to go through.
Pat, you look like you were getting ready to say something.
Well, one thing I'm thinking that we didn't mention that might be helpful to the audience is we didn't talk about really what are the symptoms of compassion fatigue. Basically, one prominent symptom is what we call intrusion. The stress and the trauma that we feel as caregivers doesn't go away. We take it home, so you can't turn it off. And that affects our ability to sleep and to concentrate and think about what we want to do. And we tend to then become avoidant. We avoid the people that we normally socialize with. Mm. We may even begin to disengage with patients, which is an area that Sean's particularly concerned about, because one more thing, you know, if I'm really stressed, going down that hallway and taking care of another patient may just be too much. And then there's a great deal of anxiety that's associated with it. Unfortunately, people who have serious compassion fatigue adopt what we call self-soothing behaviors. They overeat, they overdrink, they may overshop or acquire some other addictive behavior. And unfortunately, we see a lot of obese nurses in healthcare, and I think a lot of it is related to compassion fatigue.
Yeah, and, you know, going back to the question you had, the situation I was actually referring to, the caregiver at that point had just had two patients die on them before taking care of this patient that I was rounding on. Mm-hmm. And so going through that stress, you know, in that moment of having two patients die on you and now you're talking to another patient and you quite haven't caught up, you don't have the resiliency skills that we teach in the program to move forward.
Kathy, once you detect such symptoms in yourself, what should your first step be?
Well, after you've had the training, you kind of know that what your first steps are, and some of them are to help prevent compassion fatigue, and then some are, I almost want to say, to treat it. The preventing would be to practice the self-regulation exercises where you're trying to relax your body so that you're not as tense, you know, with every interaction or moment and that everything seems like a threat. Through all interactions, you try to relax your body. And then again, remembering, you know, intentionality or your covenant, why you chose this profession, and that the workplace is just providing you an opportunity to engage in your profession is helpful. And then the last three kick in, I want to say, after work, and that's the self-care. And we really make a push for the aerobic exercise end of it, because that's really the only way to burn off some of the epinephrine or the cortisol that's in your body that accumulates in a stressful situation.
Let's take some calls. We have a number of people who want to join the conversation. We'll begin with Lisa calling from St. Louis, who has some experience in this area, I believe. Go ahead, Lisa.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm a registered nurse case manager myself for the last 15 years, and I've also been a caregiver for my mother-in-law for the last 4 years in our home. And we recently had to place her in a nursing home because we couldn't leave her alone anymore. And, you know, going from work to home, being caregivers in both places, it's definitely stressful. And it's a big relief to have her in someone else's care now and just be the visitor in the family.
It's a real double whammy, isn't it?
It is, and I think it's very common. You know, a lot of nurses take care of family members. And it's a challenge to be able to find some kind of balance that enables an individual to get some respite, walk away, find some other resources. But again, that's easily said and done. Sometimes those resources aren't available. I can't tell you how many times I've talked to nurses who are family caregivers, but their other family members are all out of town. And so it's hard to have some alternative. To find an alternative.
You know, again, it's been a personal observation that more often than not when we're talking about home caregiving is that it's the burden that falls to the daughter, and there might be other siblings, male siblings, who just basically don't get involved. You're nodding your head.
Well, about 65% of family caregivers are female, and but there's also wives. Spouses provide a lot of the caregiving, too.
Back to the phones. Let's bring in Tracy, also calling from St. Louis. Tracy, thanks for waiting. Go ahead. Are you there,
Tracy?
Yeah, go ahead, Tracy.
Yes, my question is concerning after being a direct care patient giver for almost 30 years, working in a tertiary care center, a university setting where, you know, there's very sick and critical kids and adults, and when you then other family members, not directly your parents, let's say, but you know, your sister-in-law's mother dies, or your, you know, a friend of yours dies, it's just like, do you ever see people that have, you know, like really little response to it, like no real grief that it's just like it's part of their daily job? And
Tracy, I think we've got the point. Our connection here is not the best, but Pat, you're nodding to that.
Well, a compassion fatigue can be very numbing. Mm-hmm. You walk out or away from a busy day, or you think about at the time when you're caught within all this stress, and it can be extremely exhausting and numbing to you. But it's very important also that compassion fatigue is not the same thing as depression or other mental illnesses, and it's very important if a person's beginning to really begin to suffer. And they see it affects their work, it affects their personal relationships. They ought to seek some medical attention to try to get at what is the source. Could be some other factors causing symptoms like that.
Yeah, a lot of emotions come into play in situations like this. Another call, this time it'll be Susie calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Susie. Susie, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you so much. I wanted to let you know that at one point in my life, I seemed to suffer from compassion fatigue, and I had the wonderful opportunity to talk to a woman named Sister Helen Pregen, who was the nun who helped with dead men walking.
Right.
She helped a man. And I said to her, why is it that I feel so terrible when I'm doing social work? And she said that she found that sometimes the depth of your compassion is equal to the height of your compassion fatigue. And because of that, I realized that I did have a depth of compassion, that I wasn't crazy, that I wasn't mentally ill, but that I started working from the standpoint of resilience, that what was creating this compassion fatigue was the depth of my compassion, and that certainly that compassion could be driven to get, for me to get the right kind of help. So I just wanted to do a shout out for social workers who are working hard and are suffering, and that this might be because their resilience lies in their compassion.
Susie, thank you so much for the call. Kathy, would you agree with that in terms
of
the two extremes?
I think, as Pat mentioned, we do see it in more empathic people or those that are really feel called to caregiving, that it, you know, it does wear on you, and I think there probably is a direct relationship between your amount of compassion and your susceptibility to compassion fatigue. I think those of us that work in hospital-like settings oftentimes become desensitized to some of what we see, almost as a defense mechanism, not even realizing that it's occurring. But any profession that deals with people that are, you know, faced with unexpected consequences of illness are going to be susceptible to it.
And yet you certainly want someone who is compassionate rather than someone who has become desensitized in this line of work.
What we really want are people who can engage with patients. And patients know really quickly if a nurse is engaged and caring and is able to show compassion, not only in her words but her body movements, her nonverbal communication, and all that can be really affected when you're under compassion fatigue.
And Sean, when that is detected on the part of a patient and you get wind of it, what happens then?
You mean the nurse that's compassion fatigued, or
well, the one who as Pat just described here, the nurse who who is desensitized.
Yeah, we actually, you know, the approach that we take from the perspective of when we check on our patients and talk to them, we want to make sure that immediately after that we are doing the appropriate reward and recognition of the nurses who are performing in an outstanding fashion, that we let them know this is what the patients are saying about you. And on the other end, if there's opportunities for improvement, we also recommend that our leaders do that as well, so that there's direct feedback with regards to that process.
We have a call from Renee in St. Peter's, so I think kind of segues right into this part of the discussion. Renee, go ahead, please.
Oh, hi. I'm listening to your comment as I'm driving, and I'm so glad to hear this. I'm a nurse of 36 years. I do adult and pediatric critical care. I've had years of ER. I'm PALS and ACLS certified. And when I moved up here to be close to family, I couldn't find a job. Because they don't ask me what my age is, but they look at me as when I graduated. Well, you're almost 62. And so my experience and all my certifications don't seem to mean anything, because I think they don't want to hire older people who are about to retire, but yet I don't have this compassion fatigue. I've never had it. I keep my skills up. I enjoy what I do and have for 36 years, and I'm really sad to hear that young nurses who are just getting out that want to do this for years and love it are having so much difficulty with
Renee, let me just clarify, Renee. Sorry to interrupt, but are you basically saying you don't think you're being hired because they anticipate that you probably are compassion fatigued?
No, I think, or maybe, or they think I'm about to retire. I'm very, very qualified, but I couldn't get an answer back to me. But yet, I see the young nurses are struggling, and I know the hospitals are having trouble, but these new nurses need some older nurses who are well-grounded and who can help them through this, not just administration, but the people they work by every day.
All right.
Help them with this.
We got that. Let's see. Kathy, let's turn to you. We need more older nurses out there to help the younger ones?
I would agree with that. And I think within our hospital, we have pretty good balances of different age nurses working together and learning from one another. And I hope that Renee is able to find that, you know, fit for herself.
Sure. People reach a certain age in today's society, and it's a little harder to find jobs for a lot of reasons. Most of them wrong, if I may say so. Back to the phones, unless someone has a comment further. No, great. Let's do that. Tom will join us from Pacific. Go ahead, Tom.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I realize this is a very important topic, but I'm curious. How would you separate compassion fatigue from depression, because you really, the symptoms that you talk about are consistent, or at least close to consistent, with people who've been diagnosed with depression. And you were mentioning before that there really is not a presence of this diagnosis in the literature review, and it seems obvious why there wouldn't be, just because of the complexity of the issues involved. It'd be very difficult to establish the kind of causation that you're talking about. I'm just curious, how does this differ from depression? And have a nice day. I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks, Tom.
First of all, I'm not a clinical psychologist or psychiatrist. We need the psychologist on our team to be here. But secondary traumatic stress is in the DSM-IV manual. And so there are a subset of symptoms that I suspect are probably very uniquely different from depression, but I'm just not familiar with that. So the advice, again, I'd give, if someone is feeling a combination of the symptoms we have, and if it seems to be closely associated with their work, that may be a difference that someone would look at in a diagnosis. But it's very important for people who have these symptoms to seek some medical attention and to get some kind of screening to make sure what their problem is.
Anything to add to that? Let's go back to the phones and bring in Justin, who's waited the longest. Justin, thanks for doing so. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just had two basic questions that I guess kind of come down to who all is available to participate in this program or attend it. And my main two questions were, I can see police officers and have heard from a lot of them that, you know, compassion fatigue when you're pulling somebody over to tell somebody that their taillight's out and you have to worry that they may have a warrant and go for a gun to shoot you, or domestic violence situations often turn south very quickly. And then my second one is just a general cultural compassion fatigue when you have multiple Sandy Hook, and then you have the tornadoes tearing down schools, and you have Boston Marathon bombing and wars, and, you know, the constant inundation with news. Do people just, you know, in general, is this something you see people facing in society?
Thanks for the call. Go ahead, Pat.
Well, three parts to the question. First of all, we make our classes available only to our employees, although we have recently trained all of the other hospitals within the BJC network, and many of them, like Children's and Missouri Baptist, are looking at forming programs, even Boone Hospital in Columbia, Missouri. As far as this issue about that he was describing, really stress is at the core of all this. We spend a lot of time in the class talking about how experiences in everyday life, what we hear about and see in the media, how that triggers a stress response in us. And that can just accentuate the stress that you're experiencing as a caregiver. And going back to what Kathy was said, if you can learn to self-regulate when you're feeling the stress affecting your body, it begins to allow you to manage your what we call your sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, so that if we can switch to a parasympathetic dominance, which is the physiological mechanism behind all this, we can learn to manage stress. But it takes a lot of practice.
He mentioned also first responders. And
yes.
I know first responders are certainly subject to this. But on the other hand, there is generally a long period of time between these stressful episodes, most likely. I mean, you pull somebody over, or you have to deal, God forbid, with another Sandy Hook. You're not going to do that again the next day and the next day and the next day.
No, but they also respond to auto accidents where they see people who've been terribly injured. They see abuse cases that they have calls on. You know, it's just ongoing different kinds of really stressful, traumatic experiences that they're witnessing.
It doesn't have to be sustained then, hour by hour by hour. It can that will do it. Okay, we have time for another couple of calls. Let's bring in Mary calling from Baldwin. Go ahead, Mary.
Hi, I am a retired nurse. I'm 64 years old, and I am remembering an experience I had working in a community emergency department in the late 70s. I had a child come in who was either electrocuted or drowned, I can't remember, but he died, and he was about five, which was the age of my son, so I had a really difficult time with that. And my nursing education taught me to, you know, maintain some kind of distance with my patients, but at that time I could not. And I cried with the family, and I even went to the wake. And I think that that actually helped me.
Mary, thank you so much for the call. Kathy, I'll turn to you for that. I mean, I think we could hear emotion even to this
yes.
day in her voice. But that really brings another point to the equation, doesn't it? Seeing someone who was grievously ill who is the same age as your daughter, right, or whatever.
And I think Mary echoes what so many of us go through. Every now and then there's a case that just hits way too close to home. And it does affect you. And I think, Mary, the things that you did to help yourself grieve or get through that process were completely appropriate. And I would recommend those to others. I think we kind of get caught in thinking we have to have this sense of false bravado or that things don't bother us. But allowing your humanness to show that they do, and then doing things to refuel yourself, can certainly help.
And one of the things we're working on for next year is we're going to develop another program called Second Victim Response, where we are developing a core group of people, nurses primarily, who are going to be trained on how to go help a nurse who's experiencing a sudden acute situation, a death of a patient, maybe a mistake, medical error, giving them somebody to connect with at the time it's happening. We don't have that now.
And Sean, your take on this relationship with the family between the caregiver and the family of the patient.
Well, I've experienced it myself. I'm not a nurse, back a few years ago, I was an administrator for a neurosciences program, and there was this young patient who, instead of waiting in the reception area for his treatment, would wheel himself into my office. And every time he was there, he would hang out in my office with me while I was doing my work. And unfortunately, his treatment was not successful, and he eventually passed away. And it is trying. You get close to the patients, and it's a difficult situation for the nurses and for the other people who are involved with the family members. And we did go to the wake, actually, because a lot of us in that practice became very close to the family and to the patient, and that was rewarding. Mm-hmm.
I think it's easy to see how that could certainly happen. A final call now as our time winds down. We'll bring in Al from Collinsville. Go ahead, Al.
Hi, I'm not in the healthcare industry, and from my experience I had last year, I'd probably collapse like an origami bird. I had a friend who moved to Savannah, Georgia, and her adult son here in St. Louis suffered a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head, and he was at Barnes. I was able to provide logistic support in that I had an extra car that she could use to go back and forth and a place to live. And after 3 months of hearing about his treatment every day, it was just incredible how much it affected me. And I developed this incredible guilt because I didn't want to hear it anymore. You know, I loved her, and I visited her son only 5 times, but I couldn't imagine being a caregiver and have to deal with that on a daily basis, you know, having, you know, only had to do it through a third party. So that's my comment, and I'll take any other comments off the air.
Al, we certainly appreciate your comment, and Pat, as we wind this down, it really does take a special type to be able to deal with day-to-day and survive it emotionally.
It really does. I mean, caregiving offers so many rewards. You know, I've been a nurse since 1970, and I would never hesitate to do it again. I've loved it, but it is a challenge. It's very difficult, and I don't think any of us necessarily are always prepared to face and deal with some of the situations we have in caregiving. The compassion fatigue resiliency approach gives us some tools to really deal with it that we have not had in the past. So,
Sean, do you want to put a bottom line from your perspective on this discussion?
Well, it really is. We need to take care of ourselves in order to take care of our patients. Charity begins at home, you know, as the old saying goes.
It's a very simple concept, yes, but it certainly makes a lot of sense. And Kathy, how about a final word from you?
That, and this is kind of goes for nurses or really all caregivers, that you can continue to do what you love and care for others as long as you learn things that you can do to keep yourself healthy while you're doing it. Mm-hmm.
To thine own self be true.
Right.
I want to thank you all so much for being with us for our discussion on compassion fatigue. Kathy Powers, thank you so much for being with us. Glad you're doing so well now after your situation over there. Sean Rodriguez, good to see you. Thanks so much for being with us. And Pat Potter, great to see you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back in just a moment with another U.S. honor for Winston Churchill. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.